Hello, I am Jennifer Braverman.
And I'm Ellen Selm,
And welcome to our podcast, Stories from the Earth.
where we explore humankind's relationship and connection with the natural world.
We would like to take a quick moment to invite our listeners to consider supporting us through a humble little donation, $1, $5, or $10 a month. And the donation goes towards helping us with future projects such as launching of an herbal education curriculum. We have dubbed the People's Herb School, as well as funding to help take the show on the road and do some on-site interviews and reviews at herb farms and schools and other interesting places relevant to our podcast. Before we start the show, I'd like to make a quick note about last episode, our best of volume two. In one of the clips with Jordan Hughes, they had changed their pronouns. I was using their old pronoun, so I'd like to apologize. They now go by they, him. So I just want to apologize. And so please disregard that old pronoun when you listen to that episode. And I would like to also say that on sort of a similar note, I was listening to the latest episode of the Unruly podcast, and which is an excellent podcast. If you haven't listened to it, we had Kaylin on our show, who does they do the podcast and they do like a travel blog and all kinds of awesome stuff. And I often struggle with using guys. I say hey guys, you guys all the time, but that's kind of like not very a gender neutral term. So on this episode, they talked about the fact that y'all was or is gender neutral. So I thought that was really, really cool. Also really, really, Southern. We're in the South. The episode is the one with Robbie Lockie. It's about being non-binary, navigating climate grief, and building courage. It's really awesome. I think it's one of my favorites. So,
Nice.
yeah, check it out. And real fast, we would like to introduce. You might be hearing a little bit of a clicking sound in the background, and also occasional cat meowing. So, those are our two new podcast hosts, Amos the cat, and Kada. The tiny human.
Human.
Kate is in like a bouncy thing.
Yeah.
So to hopefully to keep her very occupied while we do this podcast.
Today's episode, we are going to do a little book review and we're going to dig into The Forest Unseen by David George Haskell, which I just stumbled across this book somewhere at some point a few years ago and thought, oh yeah, this sounds good. And I did not realize how known and recognized of a person he is in his circles, or how many other like things he's written and stuff too, which is pretty cool. I think you've got a bit about the author there.
Yeah. I mean, I often think that sometimes that happens that way where you just stumble across things and it's just like I think about a lot of the herb books I picked up or a lot of the other books and I'm like, how did I just know there's hundreds of books? Like, and I've just picked up Rosemary Gladstar's book or whatever. It's just like, oh, I had no idea. So yes, a little bit about the author, David George Haskell, which we think is how you pronounce the last name, is a dual citizen, British and American biologist, author, and William R. Kanan, Junior Professor of Biology and Environmental Studies at the University of the South in Swanahee?
Sewanee.
Swanee in Swanee, Tennessee. In addition to scientific papers, he has written essays, poems, op-eds, and the books The Forest Unseen, 2012, The Songs of Trees, 2017, 13 Ways to Smell a Tree, which sounds interesting, and Sounds Wild and Broken, 2022. Oh, so okay, so that's the newest one. The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature was winner of the 2013 National Academics Communication Award for Best Book. finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize in General Nonfiction, runner-up for the 2013 Penn/E.O. Wilson Literary Science Writing Award, and we did do a book by E.O. Wilson. Same guy, I guess?
Yeah.
Winner of the 2012 National Outdoor Book Award for Natural History Literature and the 2013 Reed Environmental Writing Award.
A lot.
Yeah. Biologist E.O. Wilson wrote that the book was a new genre of natural writing located between science and poetry. Outside Magazine listed the book among those that shaped the decade, stating that it injects much needed vibrancy into the stuffy world of nature writing. The Forest Unseen has been translated into 12 languages and was winner in translation of the 2016 Dampeng National Book Award in China. I am probably mispronouncing that. It's D-A-P-E-N-G. So, yeah.
I think it is cool that E.O. Wilson even, like, commented on the book, considering he's also a pretty, I would say, poetic sort of nature writer and biologist. And that we did happen to cover his book, Biophilia, on the show. It's like, oh.
Yeah, so if you guys want to check out
Rana Vane here.
If you guys want to check out that episode, I'll put the link to the Biophilia episode. But you know what they did? Like, when I was reading this book, I was like, oh, wait, that reminds me of a different book.
Oh, yeah.
Another kind of slowish. They have a similar pace.
Yeah. I mean, this one very much is written kind of journalistically, but Biophilia sort of was too. And it's in the way it reflects on things, it's kind of like reading a journal. So a summary of this book, this is from the cover. It says, visiting a 1 square meter patch of old growth Tennessee forest almost daily for a year, biologist David Haskell traces nature's oath through the seasons and brings the forest and its inhabitants to vivid life. Beginning with simple observations, a salamander scuttling across the leaf litter, the first blossom of spring wildflowers, Haskell spins a brilliant web of biology, ecology, and poetry. He explains the science that binds together the tiniest microbes and the largest mammals, and he describes the ecosystems that have cycled for thousands, sometimes millions of years. Written with remarkable grace and empathy, The Forest Unseen is a grand tour of nature and all its beauty and complexity. And, you know, this book is like right up my alley, obviously, and fits our show's theme, as is evidenced by its relatability to other things we've done. I really love how it blends the science and history with the scientific underpinnings into the time and place of the now, you know, like he was observing so carefully, and it evokes kind of a sense of timelessness with its reflections, even though it's like the constant march of the seasons around him. It's nice that each chapter is kind of like reading like a standalone essay in a way. Mm-hmm. Like, if you really wanted to, you could skip around in the book. You could just like pick it up and be like, I need a little dose of natural world inspiration, and flip it open and just read whatever you open it to, you know?
Or you could just like read whatever, like say I'm in, you know, whatever month I'm in.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah.
You know, start there, or like read
sort of calendar reflection of your own.
Yeah, read the intro bits, and then like jump into, because I think it starts in.
Yeah, it goes like January through December. Each chapter is like a mini story from one day's visit to the mandala. So the observation and the subject matter just kind of ensued from there. And I think the book's very special in that way, because it's accessible in its writing style for that reason, and the undertaking in terms of how he went about writing it, what he did. I mean, anybody could choose to do that, even if it was in their own backyards, you know. So it's kind of getting back to the vein of the old famed naturalist poet writers like Aldo Leopold and Henry David Thoreau and John Muir and so forth, like who's the kind of writings that beckon the reader to really drop into the magnitude and the majesty of all the beautiful simplicity and the machinations of life in the natural world. You know, it's like just sucks you in and soaks you into it like a sponge.
Yeah, and he doesn't throw too much sciencey stuff at you. Like, it's not, you don't have to know anything about anything but what you've experienced. I mean, we've in through your life, like, you don't have to know anything about science at all, or biology.
What he introduces in those veins in the book, he does it in a way, as I mean, he's a professor, so he knows how to make it accessible, right?
Okay.
Like, he does it in a way that's like, it's teachable. It's not like some really obscure, clinical, abstract, separate kind of technical writing.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel like he's teaching. It's very, yeah, like you said, it's very diary, very journal, very observation-based. He's sharing his, like, discoveries. I would say that in biophilia, that one is much more kind of sciencey, a little bit. It's sort of,
yeah, it was a little more technical, I would say.
A little more heavy hitting on that side. This is a little fluffier, but still impactful. So really good. So for me, I feel like this is a book about communication and how to see the world that is all around us, and that we affect the world and how the world affects us, because pretend we don't affect the world and we're not affected by it. This book shows us and reminds us that humans are part of the world and of the world. And it talks all about the many ways humans interact with the world around us. And it's really like a soft, low journey through the year. And you're watching like one small part of the woods. And sometimes it is a little boring. And then you're like, well, why are we talking about cute raccoons? And I don't get it. And then by the end of reading all this, like, he calls them events. I think he calls them events.
Oh, like the things that are happening in the
things that are happening.
Events, yeah.
It kind of really adds up and then stays with you. And then you're like, whoa. So there's like a lot of big ideas hidden in this like small patch of like leaves.
That's where the sort of awakening from the perspective comes in, because a lot of people might not think to go sit and observe outside, period, let alone a small portion of it, let alone so diligently, you know, consistently through the course of a year. And when somebody does take the time to do it, and you're like, oh wow, you know, like there's so much here. Like, he might just see one little thing and then he extrapolates on that one little thing to form a whole chapter, and you're like, wow, you know, like, who would have thought it was, you know, so rich, you know.
Yeah.
And he's kind of demonstrating how, you know, but wait, there's more.
He just drills down in and just gets everything that he can from it. And I wanted to say that he does do a really good job. He does do an excellent job of connecting what he's seeing and the science to like the present moment, because it just feels very, very topical to
the
now. I don't remember. We probably said when it was written.
Well, I mean, I think it was 2012.
It doesn't feel like that.
But I mean, I think that's just a testament to nature is nature is nature, in that sense that it's kind of timeless in that way, which is humbling, you know, for any human, I think, reading it, to be like, yeah, you know, this is the processional march of the seasons and the rest of life that's going on all the time, whether we pay attention to it or not. It's like a hello. What I like best about the book is probably how it's laid out and how it's written. I mean, you're reading somebody's nature diary, and it makes it really have a personal touch. As far as what I'd like least about the book, I mean, honestly, there really isn't anything I didn't like about it. I guess I would just say that each chapter is fairly short, so it just kind of gives you a little taste of whatever subject matter he's delving into as the chapter heading. And I could see how that might leave some readers kind of wishing for more juicy details on any given topic that he brings up, and it strikes their fancy. And then as soon as you're like, oh wow, Oh, chapter's over. Time for the next chapter. You know, it's just giving you a little taste.
Yeah, because you'll see once we get into the quotes that, like, it's really weird because, like, there's large sections of the book that I've not highlighted for quotes. And then, but when you have a part where, like, you're like, oh, yeah, it's great. Very meaty.
Yeah.
So he put it, but yeah, he just leaves it, boom, okay, October.
So what did you like best and or least?
So I sort of can combine them to, like, I sort of I'm putting this answer together into one, but it is a slow read because the time moves slowly in the mandala. So as a reader, you must slow down and adjust and transition. I call it mandala time. However, this is also what I like about it because it takes you out of, like, this super fast world that a lot of us live in and drops us into a different space and time altogether. You have to be there. You have to slow down. And I think whether by choice or not, a lot of us are put into sort of this fast pace, sort of maybe the different time than most nature moves on.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time in my working life, and I don't interact with nature at all. My environment is very, like, closed because I don't have any windows where I work. And also, like, my house, it's like I control the weather. Like, yeah, it's, you don't really get a sense of what the outside is like. You can control your environment. You feel kind of, it's very cut off. You know, even though I'm thankful for all these modern conveniences, I would prefer a lot more balance. So this book helps me remind me of the outside world and a world that does not always put humans at the center of the story.
I really like that point because, I mean, you know, you could argue even comparatively, since we were already talking about him, E.O. Wilson, in his writing of Biophilia, he's very much, this is my perspective, these were my experiences, in the framework of what he's talking about. Whereas because David Haskell's experiment was to just observe and remove himself from the equation otherwise, you know, the tone or the voice of the book is very different in that sense, where it is just like, it could be, it's not just, oh, this is what David George Haskell thinks about the woods of Tennessee. It's like, no, this could be any one of us, and you've just gone plop and, you know, dropped us in. So that's pretty cool.
I think Biophilia is the subject is very much humans. It's more human-centric. And this one, you know, he's definitely talking about the relationship between humans and nature, but he's, you know, talking a lot about, this is what the bug does. This is what, like, I mean, so in Biophilia too, but with the ants, but I think more so in this book is,
yeah,
sort of, he lets the non-human animals sort of take a lot more of a lead, and it really does make you feel like you're kind of observing with him, which is really cool. Really cool.
As far as learning anything from the book, I mean, lots of little things. I wasn't going to, like, throw them all out there. I mean, some of it will come up in the quotes that we picked, obviously, because they jumped out to us because they were like, aha, in our brains. But so in answer to the, not counting all those little things, the overall, like, what did I learn from this book, per se? I just found it to be a great inspirational reminder, really. Like, I didn't learn this from the book, but I was reminded from the book to take the time to really pay attention and reflect on nature when I get a chance, like when I'm out in it. The possibility of learning something fascinating about the microcosm of life within the greater macrocosm is always there, even right at our feet, out our front door. And there's definitely sort of an inner quiet and calm that comes from humbling oneself to take that moment of stillness and have those kinds of observations. And that book is just illustrating it perfectly.
Yeah, definitely. During the fall, one of the last couple of days where like the leaves were really coming down, and it was just like, just the leaves, the wind was, had picked up. So the leaves are like flying around everywhere. And I was just, I took video. I'm like, oh, I have a phone. I never take video with my phone. So I took video of it, and it's just like, I was just fascinated by just the leaves going just everywhere.
I remember when that day was going on, because I stepped outside and I was like, oh, okay. Officially fall. Like literally all of the leaves got blown off
in one day. Yeah. And I was like, tomorrow they're going to be gone. I go out for lunch as much as I can. Today I went out and it was like 41 degrees and I had so much clothes on. I was like, I'm going outside and I'm going to sit there. And I'm often surprised, this is on a little tangent, but I'm often surprised how many people don't go outside for lunch. And then they choose to sit in spaces in our work where like there's no, it's just like a cinder block box. There's this beautiful back area with these huge trees, which I've blabbed about before. Definitely. I've definitely mentioned this 100 times, but on one hand, I'm glad because I get that whole tree and picnic table to myself and no one's there. But on the other hand, I'm like, why doesn't more people go outside?
I can't speak for them at all.
I can't either. I don't know.
I will say in my own working life, this is just a weird, like, brain glitch way that my brain works. I would see people, you know, some people would go outside to take breaks because they were going to smoke or something, but like, yeah, some people would just go outside because they're like, get me out of the freaking building, you know? Yeah, and like, I wouldn't do that. And it wasn't just because where I worked before didn't have like a nice little picnic table with a tree. Maybe I would have been more inclined had they had that, but really it's, I've always been on jobs like very regimented about like just going and sitting in the break room and getting my food out of the way, kind of like just get it over with. And the weird way that it is in my head is because I literally feel like if I go outside in the middle of my shift, I can't be confident that I will come back.
Yeah.
I just don't even want to tempt myself. It's like,
yes.
Which is sad, you know.
It's how I feel every day. And my husband was like, how do you come back in? And I was like, especially on like a gorgeous spring or fall day where the weather is beautiful, and I'm like late, I take like these 10 minute power naps where I'm like, I didn't today because it's freezing, right? But then the night I'll lay on top of the picnic table and I'll just pass out, and I can see like the leaves of the trees and the sky, and it's just gorgeous and beautiful, and there's this breeze, and you're just like, oh my gosh, and it's quiet, and I'm like, one of these days they're gonna wonder where I'm at, but I'm pretty good at like 10 minutes I'm waking up and I'm like, whoa. But yeah, it's I really literally don't know how I find the strength to go back, but it's that important that I go out. So, because it just helps me feel a lot better. You're talking about calm and peaceful. So it really helps like reset my balance, my grounding. It just helps, you know, when you're sort of like in a space that you're not, you know, you can't orient yourself because you can't see like the outside, I think it is disorienting. I think it is a little disorienting. You don't realize how much it is until you go outside and you're like, oh,
yeah.
Like we had overtime and now it's dark. So when we came outside, it was dark. And we're just like, oh man, it's so dark. And then we're inside all day. And then, so that's been, people have been mentioning that and how it does affect us, so.
Sounds like it's sort of safe to say that as far as what you learned from the book, so to speak, is similar, just that connecting more and interacting more with nature. And so that's kind of your takeaway.
Yeah, the ways to interact with nature and other non-human animals. Definitely. So there were a lot of thoughts that this book brought up. I just put this in additional ideas.
Said it's always good when a book provokes extra thoughts, yeah.
It is. I don't seem to have issues with extra thoughts, though. It's interesting because I'm like, oh, I we finished reading I finished reading this book like months ago, and then I started looking at it again. I was like, oh yeah, and then I was surprised that I was able to jump right back in. If we see ourselves as separate from nature, then we have an excuse not to take responsibility for all the damage that humans have done to nature. We can go along damaging and not changing our behavior. However, if we acknowledge that we are not divided from nature and the rest of the earth, then we gain two things: the ability to take up space, the ability to be human. Oh, sorry, there's three things. And to see ourselves as humans, to, well, there's a lot of things. Hold on. The ability to take up space, the ability to be human, and to see ourselves as human, to see the good in ourselves and all the work that we need to do as a race of creatures. The other
Okay,
thing,
yeah, that's one whole thought because it's
that
all
is one
about
whole,
human. Yeah,
I
being
was
human.
writing incredibly late at night, being very tired, having deep thoughts. Like we have the ability to acknowledge both the good and the bad, who we are. I think often we're in denial about. So the other thing is that we can not ignore our responsibility to the planet that we live on, and we have to work with the other animals to keep our home healthy. If the planet is me, and if I am the planet, then it's good self-care to take care of our environment and to take care of my environment. It's just a good idea to take care of yourself. I mean, this is really in reference to thoughts about climate change and all the damage that we are doing, and kind of sucks.
I mean, to that point in what you were writing, it's like, I mean, and environmentalists and all kinds of people have made these sort of analogies ad nauseum over the years, but
Yeah.
it's true that, like, you wouldn't try to run your car on sludgy oil. You wouldn't just like want your house to be full of trash and carbon monoxide. You wouldn't, like, I mean, like, if you're
Exactly.
not going to treat your house or your body or your automobile or your yard or whatever in these ways, collectively, would we treat the planet in this way? Like, we have to be able to go take it further,
I mean, people have issues. People do not treat themselves right. People do like not clean their homes or their
Well,
car.
yeah,
I
but
mean,
like,
people do not take.
overall, blanketedly, most humans would agree
Right, that is a
they
good
don't
idea
want to
too.
be like that. They don't want,
Right.
and yet, most people, well, I don't know about most, but like, and yet, there's plenty of people who wouldn't stop to think of how we, on a grand scale, impact the planet,
Yeah.
Like, well, but if you'd be thinking about these things, why is it such a leap to, think about the whole space that we all occupy,
I think it's just because we've been like like our whole society seems to work to separate us. So it's like we don't see it. We can't, it's harder to see these connections that are there. Like basically like what I do all day, it doesn't have anything to do with the nature and the planet, but it does have an impact, and in its essence, it's damaging. Like I'm just literally like it's hard. It's like I want to know about these things, but then like I can't stop thinking about them, and some of them are really depressing, and I go around and I'm like, can we stop doing that? I mean, could we?
It's
But
all connected. Moral of the story is.
it's too connect. It's a big, some people would say a web. Others can be like a knotted ball of twine. It's just very complex, I think.
Yeah.
So we definitely can't see everything.
Okay, so who would you recommend this book for? I think that the format of the book is simple enough that most people could read it and probably enjoy it and get something out of it, which is hence no doubt why it's been nominated and won so many awards around the world. But simple doesn't mean simplistic. It's not like it's dumbed down by any means. It has educational value to its contents, which I think can help people get better acquainted, like we're talking about, with aspects of nature. And the overall concept of sitting, observing, and admiring it with a keen scientific eye, you know, we can see that those two things don't have to be mutually exclusive, which is cool.
As I get my best ideas in the bathroom, this idea would have hit me over the head. This book reminds me of an old PBS Nature documentary. I don't know if anybody used to watch Nature, but I love it. I loved it. And I can't remember if this guy had a British accent in the Nature documentary, but I could just hear this guy with a British accent and then see the slow motion close-ups as of the insects as they go about their lives. And that's what this book like reminds me of. So anyone who likes this kind of slow deep dive will probably like this book. The British guy, I can't remember his name. He does other ones. He does other.
Are you thinking of David Attenborough?
David Attenborough. Yeah. One of his, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. If they, oh man, if they did an audio book, they should have had him read it. That would have been cool.
Oh, they do have an audio book.
Well, but I mean, like.
Yeah, but he just doesn't read it. I don't.
So we pulled out some quotes we like, kind of in order of the flow of the book. And so we'll just share some of those with y'all now and have a chat about whatever strikes our fancy. So.
Yes, we have.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
We have quite a lot of quotes. So they were not. Yeah. We just went, I don't know. I think there was a thought to go through and, you know, make it smaller, pare them down. That did not happen. So it's going to be cool bonanza.
Well, starting, as would be fitting, with a little snippet from the intro, I think, as it kind of sets the stage, obviously. One translation for the word mandala is community, and he talks about a group of ecology students, I would guess probably his students, I don't know, but they were observing some Buddhist monks making one of the sand mandalas, and then they later were going to go out in the woods and put a hoop down on the ground and call that their mandala and spend the rest of the day observing the forest community in that circle. And so he writes, the parallel runs deeper than this congruence of language and symbolism. I believe that the forest's ecological stories are all present in a mandala-sized area. Indeed, the truth of the forest may be more clearly and vividly revealed by the contemplation of a small area than it could be donning 10-league boots covering a continent, but uncovering little. And then another part of the intro, he says, as he decides to undertake his own sort of mandala observation, he says, I sit next to the mandala on a flat slab of sandstone. My rules at the mandala are simple. Visit often, watching a year pass, be quiet, keep disturbance to a minimum, no killing, no removal of creatures, no digging in or crawling over the mandala. The occasional thoughtful touch is enough. I have no set schedule for the visits, but I watch here many times each week, and this book relates the events in the mandala as they happen. So I thought that was worth pointing out, because if anybody did want to be like, oh, this is cool, I'm going to do this own experiment in my own backyard, it's like, well, then there's your rules.
I like that he has no set schedule for visits.
Yeah, it's just kind of like, eh, I guess I'll take a little bit of time here, a little bit of time there. In the chapter, January 21st, The Experiment, he's going into a lot of information about cold and how cold impacts different creatures and things. He does a little experiment where he decides to take all of his clothes off and it's negative 20 degrees outside. He's making note of like almost how quickly, you know, his body's starting to go into shock. He says, my own physiological inadequacy in the cold also has origins in natural selection. I'm out of place in the mandala because my ancestors dodged selection for cold hardiness. Humans evolved from apes that lived for tens of millions of years in tropical Africa. Keeping cool was a much bigger challenge than keeping warm, so we have few bodily defenses against extreme cold. When my ancestors left Africa for Northern Europe, they brought with them fire and clothes, carrying the tropics to the temperate and polar regions. This cleverness produced less suffering and fewer deaths, unquestionably good outcomes, but comfort sidestepped natural selection. So we're condemned by our skill with fire and cloth to be forever out of place in the winter world. Darkness comes and I retreat towards my inheritance, the warm hearth, leaving the mandala to the avian masters of the cold. This mastery was earned the hard way, thousands of generations of struggle. I wanted to experience the cold as the mandala's animals do, but I now realize that that's impossible. My experience has come through a body that has taken a different evolutionary path from the chickadees, precluding any fully shared experience. Despite this, my nakedness in the cold wind has deepened my admiration for these others. Astonishment is the only proper response. And another part of that same chapter, he said, and I just pulled this one little quote out, natural selection's paradox, from death comes life's increasing perfection. And I just thought that that was interesting to think about because, especially when he's talking about, like, by the time humans moved out of tropical region, they had fire and they had clothing. And so, in a sense, we've like, I don't know, like, I don't want to sound super negative, but it's like, how many humans doom themselves by removing natural selection from our existence? If we're going to continue to survive healthfully and we're not going to do it through natural selection because we've more or less evolved ourselves past participation in that fully, then it really does come down to having to come up with sort of scientific means to, and this is a slippery slope, right? I mean, because some people have like used it as an excuse for eugenics and horrible things like that. Say, you know, it's all consensual, right? And nothing forced and manipulated, and no genocide, etc. It seems like we're going to have to recognize that through our technologies and our science and understanding, we'll be able to do things like, you know, hopefully one day completely obliterate all cancer and, you know, things like that, you know, because it's like, if we're not going to be physically evolving anymore in ways that can neutralize over generations time certain destructive things, then we're going to have to use our smarts to come up with means, much like we did with fire and clothing, to combat the ills that would otherwise befall, you know?
Yeah.
That was an interesting thing. That was my tangent thought from his one little quote there. Let's see. In his February 2nd chapter, Footprints, he says, only when photosynthesis was invented about 2.5 billion years ago did oxygen become part of Earth's air. And because oxygen is dangerous, a reactive chemical, this poisoning of the planet wiped out many creatures and forced others into hiding. These oxygen haters live to this day in lake bottoms and swamps and deep in the soil, eating out an existence in oxygen-free environments. Other creatures adapted to the new pollutant and, using an elegant sidestepping maneuver, turned the toxic oxygen to their advantage, and thus was born respiration using oxygen, an energy-liberating biochemical trick that we have inherited. Our lives, therefore, depend on an ancient form of pollution. And I thought, yeah, that's an interesting thing to think about.
That yeah,
there was life on this planet, and it was not oxygen dependent.
Like, this is the first time I have ever heard about that. Like, I don't remember in school ever discussing.
I guess I'm sure, like, talking about anaerobic, you know, microbes or whatever, you know, but like, yeah, it's just, he called it out in such a way that really made you go, whoa, you know.
Yeah, it's just an interesting thought. That's something that was poisonous to
the planet
we are now
at the time. Yeah,
we are now living on, and we
need and the world live. Became richer for it. That's what's crazy too. Yeah,
in this instance, yeah. But a lot of animals became extinct, probably. So there was like a trade-off.
Pulled this quote out from the chapter March 13th, Hepatica, because of our love for herbs and plants. I thought this was such a great little tidbit. He says, "The tension between the medical establishment and the quacks continues, of course. The astrological doctrine of signatures now finds itself out of favor. Our physicians no longer believe that God left providential medicinal hints in the shapes of leaves and the arrangement of stars. We should not, however, be too quick to dismiss the doctrine of signatures as trifling superstition. As a method of cultural transmission of medical knowledge, the doctrine was a powerful organizing device, richer and perhaps more coherent than the mnemonics used by modern physicians to navigate their large drawers of knowledge. The method gave healers, most of whom couldn't read, linguistic cues to connect patient symptoms with the sometimes arcane details of botanical identification and medical knowledge. The doctrine of signatures persisted for so many years, not because our ancestors were simple-minded, but because it was so useful." And I thought that was just such a good treatment of that thought. You know, he wasn't going to go like, "Well, I'm a scientist and they were superstitious Neanderthals," you know, like, it's like, no, sometimes there's a reason these things stick around. You know, it might not be relevant to medical science per se, but it doesn't mean it didn't have a relevancy.
It's like they're coming, the thing works no matter what, because it's something about the world and how it works and science, this thing we call science. So it doesn't matter if you don't understand it or if you think it works, because if the reason you think it works is because of a different thing.
Right.
But
yeah.
It still works. And I think that's the most important, I guess.
He said, reflecting more on that same plant that he was observing in his mandala hoop, "Hepatica's name reveals our culture's propensity for naming plants after their uses. This method of naming helps us remember humanity's dependence on plants for medicines and foods. But utilitarian names can also stand in the way of a full experience of nature. For example, our nomenclature has its telology wrong. Hepatica exists not to serve us, but to live its own story, one that began in the forests of Europe and North America, millions of years before humans even came to be. Likewise, our naming imposes tidy categories on nature. These may not reflect life's complicated genealogies and reproductive exchanges. Modern genetics suggests that boundaries in nature are often more permeable than we suppose when we give things the names of separate species. On this bright morning in the early spring, Hepatica's confident welcome of the first warm sun and flying bees reminds me that the mandala exists independent of human doctrines. Like all people, I am culture bound, so I only see the flower. The rest of my field of vision is occupied by centuries of human words."
So we don't know what the flower calls itself. We don't know what the Hepatica calls itself. Something like that, right?
Yeah, I just thought that was a very nicely poetic way of him basically saying, like, "Oh, we humans, we like to think we know everything, but really this thing was here long before us and could possibly go on long after us. Like, you know, what do we know?
What do we know?
All relative."
There's this podcast called, I think it's The Fall of Civilizations, and it's all about all these civilizations that have big civilizations like that have sprung up in parts of the world, and now they're just like rubble, ruins, and it's just amazing. Like some of these, like especially like in China, like you could
live about the scale of what has been.
Yeah. You could live under these are the thousands of years. Like just it could be 1,000 years, and that's how the life, the world is, and that it's just gone because of various reasons, sometimes climate change, sometimes, you know, corruption and all kinds of other stuff, natural disasters, things like that. But yeah, so it just was there and now it's gone. And they probably thought the world was, the world looked very different to them, looked one way.
Yeah, like, and they probably thought, well, this is it.
This is it.
It'll be forever.
Right.
And here that's we are in a country that's only a couple, you know,
100 years old.
And I, in age comparatively, and yeah.
Right, yeah. It's a really great podcast. So this is from August 8th, and the chapter heading is Earth Star.
Pretty name.
I know. I really like that. But to love nature and to hate humanity is illogical. Humanity is part of the whole. To truly love the world is also to love human ingenuity and playfulness. Nature does not need to be cleansed of human artifacts to be beautiful or coherent. Yes, we should be less greedy, untidy, wasteful, and short-sighted, but let us not turn responsibility into self-hatred. Our biggest failing is, after all, lack of compassion for the world, including ourselves.
That's very well said.
Yeah, very well said. Therefore, I resolved to leave the golf balls in the mandala. So this is where he just found some golf balls and he was like, should I leave them to take them out, or because they're not natural? I guess that's what he was trying to think about. Or maybe they are natural, right? I think he goes into a whole thing about what is a golf ball or what makes up a golf ball. I continue removing strange plastic objects from the rest of the forest, but not from here. There is value in keeping a patina of naturalness along hiking trails and in gardens. Our harried eyes need a visual break from the productions of industry. And I highlighted that one because I think that's really, really true.
That sums up your taking a break on the picnic table.
Yeah. That's like my whole life. Like
a break from the production of industry.
Yes, definitely. Keeping woods trash free is a symbol of our desire to be more careful members of life's community. But there is also value in the discipline of participating in the world as it is, discarded golf balls and all.
See the point he was making, although I'm willing to bet there were probably people who were like, what? He shouldn't have left those there.
I mean, maybe he took them out afterwards.
Yeah.
But like for the experiment, left them in.
Yeah.
Because that's the world.
You observing.
Yeah. We're part of the world, and so is our golf balls. Look at our new co-host. She's being so cute now.
The wonders of a short little nap.
And is she eating that towel?
Pretty much.
Oh, okay.
It's her favorite thing to chew on is these little cloths.
It works. It works. Okay.
That's what you think.
No, okay then. Very, very astute observation there. So we're going to go right into, this was October 5th. Alarm waves. The mandalas, birds, and mammals live embedded in an acoustic network, each individual connected to others through sound. The forest news ripple through this network, carrying the latest information about the location and activities of troublemakers. It takes some effort for us urbanized humans to be aware of the traveling signals. We're accustomed to ignoring background noise, instead taking our cues from the interior noises of our mind. Most of my time sitting or walking in the woods is spent riding waves inside my head, thinking of the past or future. I suspect that this is a common experience. Only a repeated act of will can bring us back to the present, back to our senses.
Meditation, more or less.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what he's doing in his observational visits. Sort of a type of meditation in a way.
Again, active, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's active, but it's still very, like, present instead of getting jumbled in the past and the future or whatever.
Right. It's like, what's going on with this leaf here? Yeah. When I sit or walk in the forest, I'm not a subject observing objects. I enter the mandala and am caught up in webs of communication networks of relationships, whether or not I'm aware of it. I change these webs by alarming deer, startling a chipmunk, or stepping on a living leaf. Disassociated observations is not possible in the mandala. The web also changed me. The web changed me. It should be also changed me. Web also changed me. Every inhalation carries hundreds of airborne molecules into my body. These molecules are the aromas of the woods, the combined fragrance of thousands of creatures. Some aromas are so pleasing to humans that we have domesticated them, extracting perfumes. At least one such perfume, jasminate, is an alarm chemical communicating danger among plants. Perhaps our olfactory aesthetics reflect a desire to be webbed to nature's struggle. I'm assuming he's talking about like jasmine.
I wonder. That's really interesting because I used to have a thunderstorm phobic dog and almost nothing really helped. But like the smell of jasmine or like tasting jasmine tea,
mm-hmm.
she really, really liked that. Like it had a very mild, calming sort of effect. And I'm like, well, these plants put out this chemical signature as an alarm, and then mammals turn around and perceive it as something pleasant. That's so strange.
But perfumes are the exception. Most of the forest molecules bypass my sense of smell and dissolve directly into my blood, entering my body and mind below the level of consciousness. The effects of our chemical interpretation with plant aromas are largely unstudied. Western science hasn't stopped to take seriously the possibility the forest, or lack of it, might be part of our being. Yet forest lovers know very well that trees affect our minds. The Japanese have named this knowledge and turned it into a practice called, and I meant to figure out how to pronounce this, Shinrin-yaku?
It's probably yoku. Most of the times when Japanese is put into transliteration, it sounds very much like how it's written.
Yeah. So it's called or bathing in forest air. It seems that participation in the mandala's community of information may bring us a measure of well-being at the wet chemical core of ourselves.
Ah, yes. That squishy, wet chemical core.
And, you know, and that's what I'm doing when I'm outside with my tree and my 10-minute nap.
Recharging your wet chemical core.
Yes. Recharging my wet chemical core, which may be the subtitle of this episode.
Join us and recharge your wet chemical core.
I mean, I can definitely tell a difference.
Especially, like, you know, one place to another, the different smells. Like, that's definitely something that can impact any person, even if they wouldn't generally consider themselves very attuned to nature. You know, you just can't not notice it, you know? Like, there's the distinct smell in the North Carolina woods, especially after it rains, of, like, the rhododendron and mountain laurel, which is reminiscent of, like, gym socks in a locker. But you smell it and you're like, ah, yes. Home.
Home. The stink of home.
Oh, and then you had said something earlier about his observation of some raccoons, and so I think you had a quote.
Yeah, I had a quote. I thought this was just adorable. And it makes me think of how, because we get bears.
The traipse through Asheville.
Through habitat loss. I was at work and my husband was like, there's bears out.
Like literally right out the window?
Well, we have a
stream.
Yeah. We have a stream outside our apartment and a small amount of woods. There's big like rocks and there's this like bear family and they were like there. And I have like a picture.
Wow.
It kind of like blurs because his cell phone camera was zooming enough, but I was like, that's so cool. So I was thinking about that. And they're cute. I mean, they're so cute, but like, you know, you basically are like, okay,
stay cute over there.
right. I mean, and one time I was walking where we used to live, which is even closer to like downtown Asheville, and a whole bunch of us were just watching these little cubs decimate a trash can. And we were like, from across the street, we're just like, oh, this is the best entertainment. We're just watching these little bears. Okay, anyway. So this is October 19th, and this is called Faces, this little chapter. 12 paws paddle the litter, as three raccoons trundle towards me. Their moments are focused, calm, and purposeful. They seem to glide down the hill like mammalian caterpillars, fuzzied in silvery gray. They are slightly smaller than the adults that I see in these parts. Perhaps they are young of the year, born in the spring. My reaction to the raccoons was that of surprise, a jolt of excitement as the strange sound resolved into the advancing trio. Then the raccoons appearing faces come close. Dark velvet masks set in crisp white borders, obsidian eyes, rounded ears, peaked jauntily, and slender noses. All this set in tufts of silver fur. One thing was evident. These animals were adorable. My zoological self was immediately embarrassed by these thoughts. Naturalists are meant to have outgrown such judgment. Cute is for children and amateurs, especially when applied to a common animal like raccoon. I try to see animals for what they are, independent beings, not as projections of desires leaping unbidden from my psyche. But like it or not, the feelings were there. I wanted to pick up a raccoon and tickle it under the chin. Surely this was the ultimate humiliation of the zoologist's scientific Hauteur, Hauteur. We're gonna see what Google says. Hauteur. I don't know if you've heard that. That is what is the definition of that? Pride, arrogance, contempt, yeah, snobbishness.
Logical snobbishness.
Yes, they're being very snobby. There's more. There's more to that quote. As the raccoons walk away, crunching over the dry litter, I sense that my observation of the forest has held up a mirror to my own nature, a mirror that is less clouded here than in this synthetic modern world. My ancestors lived in community with animals of forests and grasslands for hundreds of thousands of years. As in all species, my brain and my psychological affinities have been built by these millennia of ecological interactions. Human culture now modifies, blends, and transforms my mental predispositions, but it does not replace them. By returning to the forest, Abet, as an observer rather than a full participant in the communication in the community, my sociological inheritance starts to reveal itself.
Sentiment and be like, yeah, even though we can separate ourselves all we want, if we just give ourselves a chance to kind of drop in, it's amazing how quickly we might be able to just sort of lean into those more anxious parts of ourselves.
It's like we start to sort of remember things, or part of our brain remembers things, or it's just like, wait, this is sort of familiar. It's just, it's interesting how we just, they just wake up. They're like, ooh, we didn't lose them. They're still just
hiding under the surface.
Yeah. My last quote is from December 31st, and it is called Watching. Despite this feeling of belonging, my relationship to this place is not straightforward. I simultaneously feel profound closeness and unutterable different distance. As I have come to know the mandala, I have more closely seen my ecological and evolutionary kinship with the forest. This knowledge feels woven into my body, remaking me, or more precisely, waking in me the ability to see how I was made all along, was what we were just talking about. At the same time, an equally powerful sense of otherness has grown. As I have watched, a realization of the enormity of my ignorance has pressed on me. Even simple enumeration and naming of the mandala's inhabitants lie far beyond my reach. An understanding of their lives and relationships in anything but a fragmentary way is quite impossible. The longer I watch, the more alienated I become from any hope of comprehending the mandala, of grasping its most basic nature. Yet the separation that I feel is more than a heightened awareness.
Very interested in this part.
I think she's liking it. I've understood in some deep place that I am unnecessarily here, as in humanity. There is loneliness in this realization. Poignancy. Propugnancy? Prognancy? Oh my gosh.
Poignancy.
Poignancy in my irrelevance. But I also feel an ineffable but strong sense of joy in the independence of the mandala's life. Somehow, this shock of separateness flooded me with relief. The world does not center on me or my species. The casual center of the natural world is a place that humans have no part in making. Life transcends us. It directs our gaze outward. I feel both humbled and uplifted by the woodpecker's flights. So I continue my watch, both stranger and kin at this mandala. The bright moon lifts the forest in a lambent silver light. As my eyes adjust to the night, I see my shadow in the moonlight resting across the circle of leaves.
That's kind of a nice reflection on being like, oh gosh, yes, here's how we've separated ourselves. Here's how I feel separated. And yet, what does it really matter? You know, like almost like he's like, oh my gosh, these feelings are coming up. And yet then it's like also like, well, who am I and how important is it? It's like this life exists regardless of my relation to it, sort of thing. And then seeing that kind of recognition as a humbling thing is a nice, it's that tricky thing, you know, it's like why when sometimes, you know, people can look up at the night sky and think about all these stars and galaxies and all this stuff far, far away. And some people will just be like, wow, and they'll feel so small and insignificant, and that terrifies them. And then other times people will be like, they feel so small and insignificant, and it's like he described it, a relief, you know, because it's like, you know what, all the pressure and everything that you put on yourself, what is it at the end of the day? Life goes on, you know. So that's a kind of him exploring that there. I thought that was nice.
It's not my responsibility to save the world, but I mean,
you just do your own part.
Yeah.
You're not responsible for all of it.
All of it.
Look at these little toes.
Oh my gosh, they're so cute. Okay, all right. So if you're watching on YouTube, you will see the cutest little toes in the world.
So in conclusion, the epilogue, this is just a little snippet of the epilogue, but it seems like a perfect way to wrap up the show. He says, it's commonplace for contemporary naturalists to deplore our culture's increasing disconnection from the natural world. I can sympathize with this complaint, at least in part. When asked to identify 20 corporate logos and 20 common species from our region, my first year students can consistently name most of the corporate symbols and almost none of the species. The same would be true for most people in our culture, but ours is not a new lament. Carl Linnaeus, one of the founders of modern ecology and taxonomy, wrote of the botanical abilities of his 18th century compatriots, few eyes see and few minds understand, and through this want of observation and knowledge, the world suffers immense loss. Much later, Aldo Leopold, reflecting on the state of the world in the 1940s, wrote, your true modern is separated from the land by many middlemen and physical gadgets. He has no vital relation to it. Turn him loose for a day on the land, and if the spot does not happen to be a golf links or a scenic area, he is bored stiff. It seems that the skilled naturalists have always felt that their culture was perilously close to losing its last scrap of connection to the land. Both men's words resonate with me, but I also feel that in some ways we now live in a better time for naturalists. Interest in the community of life is more widespread and vigorous than it has been for decades, perhaps centuries. Concern for the fate of ecosystems is part of our national and international political discourse. In less than a human lifetime, the fields of environmental activism, education, and science have grown from insignificance to prominence, and the question of how to heal our disconnection from nature has become a popular topic for educational reformers. All of this interest is perhaps something new and encouraging.
Yeah. I didn't think about it like that. That in the past it was even, apparently the same issue was happening for a while. I love how these dudes put them. Physical gadgets.
Yes.
What's a physical
gadget? It was like, oh my goodness, he had no idea what was coming down the pike.
Do you know that we had steam-powered cars before we had, at least that's what I heard from a podcast, before we had combustion engines? Yeah.
I mean, I know that there was a lot of different experimental ways to fuel
automobiles.
And there used to be, like, in all the old cartoons where the car would break down.
That point that he's made, that, like, just, like, we have this, we feel like, oh, this problem has gotten worse and worse and worse. So we're just getting more and more
cut
off.
But it's like it didn't even used to get talked about in politics. And it wasn't a entire field of study in higher education. And it is now. And to point out that all of that's been in less than a human lifetime, really, how much some of that stuff has grown. When you think about that in the time scale of humanity, that is very promising because it shows like how quickly, relatively, we can turn things around. It may not feel like quick enough, which is why there still should be urgency in relation to, you know, addressing climate change and whatnot. But like, it shows that there's promise.
Yes.
There could be answers and means to tackle these issues.
And
we actually could have the capability.
Enough people are concerned, and there's enough of a movement in that direction to create all this activism and education and things like that. And sometimes it feels like, yeah, it does nothing, and it has done nothing. And we've had 20 plus years of climate conferences and they've done nothing. So, you know, it's like, well, that's depressing. It sounds like not nothing has happened.
Yeah, like not nothing has changed.
Not nothing has changed.
And we've got, you know, going on, you know, 100 years or so from a major industrial revolution that, like, okay, well, 20 years countering that isn't that much when you put it into that scale of reference. So, not to say we should be taking 100 years of our sweet time to correct things.
They don't seem to say we have 100 years. I don't know. I feel like depending on how things happen, I'd be able to see a lot of
change.
Yeah. I don't know. Just thinking about how much will change in that time. But we just don't know what's going to happen. I do feel like there still needs to be more people in power that
get stuff done.
Yeah. That cares enough to, you know, lend a hand instead of going the other way. Do we have any final thoughts?
I'm definitely interested to check out his other books now.
Yeah.
I think I actually might have Song of the Trees and just haven't read it. I didn't even know he had two new works out since then even, so that's cool.
Yeah, maybe we'll do them on the podcast if they seem like they would be good fits.
But yeah, I would say, you know, if you didn't check out any other book that we've ever talked about, but have an interest in, you know, natural history, which is the category this falls under, but it's kind of a weird term in my opinion, because history to me, it seems to imply like you're looking back at something,
right?
And this is like, well, no, this is ongoing everyday life in the woods. But if you're interested in that sort of thing, and you just want to learn a lot about a lot of little things about a lot of little things, then this is probably the best book to just go right to, because it's very accessible, and for the easy read that it is, it does actually cram in quite a bit of cool stuff. So.
It sneaks it right in. You don't even notice it, and until you do, and you're like, oh, whoa. But yeah, especially if you want to do this experiment yourself, and would be fun to do a supplemental experiment alongside reading this book, do our own podcast mandala. But I'm not, I am definitely not going out in minus 20 degree weather.
No.
No.
Maybe next summer we can do a little mini version.
Ooh. That sounds fun. Yes. All right. So, but before we do the final wrap up, I just want to tell you everyone, the next book that we're going to be reading is Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist and Other Essays by Paul Kingsnorth. This is what the book looks like. It's black with like kind of greenish letters. There's
divided into a couple episodes because it's got a lot of material.
Yeah, this one is jam-packed. But just for frame of reference, there's another book on Amazon, so it's confusing of which version, but this is a black one with kind of, yeah, weird greeny letters. It's very good. So yeah, if you wanted to like read this as we're reading it. All right. So thank you everyone for joining us today. You can find us on TikTok now. Woohoo! We're all in with the new hotness. And also on Instagram, YouTube. And you can listen to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Anchor. Yep, we have a Facebook group. And all the links are in the description. And if you'd like to support us, you can support us through Anchor, $1, $5, or $10 a month. And we really appreciate the support. And also, you can support us by leaving a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Until next time, we do try to get 2 episodes a month out. Sometimes it is 1. Oh, but there's our new, well, we can't necessarily blame it all on you, co-host.
The new co-host is still learning the ropes.
yes, exactly. All right. Yeah. Until next time, everyone.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah. Bye.